Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome, all of my friends out there in UFO hood. This is Alejandro Rojas, and you are listening to Open Minds Radio. I am going to be a little bit delirious, possibly, because I just got back from not that long of a trip. It's just a short plane ride, a skip and a jump over to California, because I was in the Bay Area in San Leandro, which is very similar to Alejandro. Beautiful area. I've never been to the Bay Area. Well, I was in San Jose. Funny enough, the last time I was in the Bay Area, San Jose, I was kind of stuck in a hotel because it was for a MUFON symposium, and that very symposium was very related to our guest today, which is a wonderful guest, Leslie Keene, who's just been making all kinds of big news all over the place with her new book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And the reason the San Jose convention for MUFON was related is because she helped us, and we had a lot of those international generals, pilots, and everything at that symposium to speak. So it was awesome. It was a beautiful place. And funny enough, I guess the thing that I was at this weekend was to help run to get funds for MUFON in Northern California, because they're still trying to pay off that event, to be completely honest with you. It was very expensive. It was nice because there are so many international people. It was incredible to see all these people, like General De Bauer from Belgium, who was the Air Force guy who investigated the Belgium Triangle Wave, which so many people are familiar with. An incredible case, and a lot of incredible cases. We'll be talking about a lot of all of these cases with Leslie Keene. And we also got to see James Fox out there at this event, because he was showing a couple of his shows. This was kind of a film fest type of thing, along with some speakers. And James Fox and Leslie Keene actually worked together to do this press conference in Washington, D.C., where they had originally got all these people together that she includes in her book. So that's when it all began. Then we caught on to the tail end of that with MUFON and brought those people back. And then she got statements from all of these guys, put it into an incredible book, and then got that book out recently. And it has been a hit, a New York Times bestseller on UFOs and very credible, interesting stuff. Obviously, there are a lot of people interested in UFOs out there. And you all know that because you're listening to a UFO radio show. So obviously, you guys are really interested. So we have a great show tonight. I'm very excited about this show. And I'm very excited about the event that we got to go to, the UFO X-Fest. And we'll talk more about that a little later. A couple other things. We got to introduce our new magazine, which isn't even out yet, but some of those people in the Bay Area got a sneak peek and got to get copies of those for you subscribers. We'll be mailing those out tomorrow because they just got printed. And this one's about UFO landings, and it has more to do with the Rendlesham Forest. All of that incident in detail is in this one, and which is really exciting. And those were things that were also in Leslie Keene's book. She had Charles Halt, who was the deputy base commander, to later become the base commander at the base, the Bentwaters base, where this all took place, and James Peniston, who was the guy, we've had him on our show, an incredible show. I mean, he is a very credible person. You know, he's a very sober, careful person, the way he describes what he experienced that evening when he went and touched a craft in the forest, and that was days after Christmas in 1980. So really cool stuff in the magazine that you'll be getting very soon. Only we've seen it. You can call your buddies in the Bay Area. Say, hey, man, what's in that magazine? Did you get one? As you know, we have a new time and no commercials. Yay, there's so many people out there that are going, yes. They're in their cars like, all right, listening to the podcast there. Everybody loves no commercials. And honestly, you know what? I hate commercials. I listen to public radio. I watch public television. Or I watch internet TV and stuff because I cannot stand commercials. I watch C-SPAN. All this C-SPAN because they don't have commercials, thank goodness. I'm not a fan of commercials, so it is very cool that we don't have commercials now. We just have a couple little reminders about cool products that Open Minds has here and there to give ourselves a break so we can blow our noses or do anything else we have to do and do that off camera to spare you the visual there. So, and we're an hour and a half. That means we're going to have a full hour plus with Leslie King. There are people out there giggling like little schoolgirls because they're just so excited about this interview. I know it. Also, the UFO Congress is getting more and more solidified, and we are having more and more people contact us. Like, the whole world of ufology is begging, and I'm not even kidding when I say some of these people are really begging to speak at this conference because it's going to be so incredibly cool here in Phoenix in late February. So you guys, you know, you think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. You know, you can ask Jason, you can call us up and be like, you know, hey, Maureen, you know, and I've mentioned her before. Was that Alejandro guy exaggerating? Ask Jason. He'll tell you, nope. They are banging on the doors, harassing us. We're going to have to get restraining orders on some of these people, I'm afraid, before it's all said and done because they just want to speak so bad. But we also have some people that are kind of surprises that we're kind of holding in our pocket here that we're probably going to be able to get. And unfortunately, I can't tell you who, but when you hear, you're just going to be... Yet again, you're going to be giggling like little schoolgirls, and you're just going to be so excited. So I would recommend you get your tickets early. You can go to our website. You can go to openminds.tv or ufocongress.com and register right now. You can reserve your hotel room. Beautiful, beautiful hotel, wonderful rooms. And make sure you get a room in the hotel because they're probably going to sell out pretty quick. And if you don't get a room in the hotel, you're going to have to be down the street, and that's just not going to be as fun. That'll still be a lot of fun. You'll just have to take a shuttle ride, and, you know, if someone calls you and says, oh, man, you cannot believe what this dude's saying, you're going to have to jump on a shuttle to try to get over there, and it's just going to be easier if you stay at the hotel. So once we are done, you're done listening to the show, go ahead and go register for your room and for the conference, all right? That's my advice for you. And, of course, on the website, as usual, and now our news is sponsored on MUFON because really, and it, maybe this is just my opinion, but I think, you know, it probably is the most updated news feed where we give you all of the news in the conventional media that's going on out there about UFOs. And UFOs are in the news like crazy. In fact, my talk in San Leandro about this was kind of focused on some of this stuff, including China, and how China all of a sudden is becoming UFO crazy. They're having all kinds of stuff in the news about UFOs, and I'm sure Jason, our news correspondent, is going to tell us all about that. He looks really excited to give us some news. So, Jason, why don't you just go ahead and get in there and give us some UFO news, buddy.
Greetings, Alejandro, and hello, world. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, September 20th, 2010. A retired Air Force officer, Stanley A. Fulham, recently wrote a book that predicts a massive UFO display above Earth's major cities on October 13th of this year. The author of this 352-page book believes that this will be the first interaction leading to humanity's acceptance of extraterrestrials, and with help from their technology, we will be able to remove the dangerous levels of carbon monoxide from Earth's atmosphere. Fulham's book, Challenges of Change, draws on his military career in the Air Force and with NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. After announcing the exact date for this supposed extraterrestrial interaction, he safely clarifies that there are no absolutes and the extraterrestrials may postpone their visit. So he's playing it a little safe there.
Yeah,
it's going out on a limb and saying, this date is when we're going to have this huge show.
That's what others should do, hedge their bets. What's interesting, of course, is there's people saying this kind of stuff all the time, as we know. And it's not like I'm thinking, you know, because he's saying it, it's going to happen any more than, you know, any of these other people that we've come across. But his background is what's so interesting. I mean, this real military background, he really worked at NORAD, and I know Antonio was looking it up also. Very interesting.
And, you know, like our guest will mention tonight, we're seeing a lot more of that. These military officials, government officials actually coming out and discussing things based on their experience with the military, with the government.
Hopefully that trend continues.
Just months after a UFO shut down an airport in China, it happened again, but at a different airport in China. Reports state that a UFO hovered near the airport for an hour, causing incoming planes to be diverted to other airports as a safety precaution. And, as with the incident back in July at a different airport, no official explanation has been given.
Yep. And, well, and as we talked about before, it could be one of those Chinese billionaire guys who have those Learjets that kind of just do whatever the heck they want. But who knows? I mean, they're shutting down airports.
Which means there's definitely something there.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully somebody knows, but they're not telling anybody else.
Hopefully we get some real pictures or video.
And that's been the issue. There's been a lot of these claimed photos, but they turn out to be something completely different, not associated with the incidents.
You know what else is weird with this one is that it really hasn't made it over to American media. It was kind of a little blip.
There's a possibility that it did, but after the last airport incident and because of their own fault of
misreporting,
getting their information from YouTube and not really doing their research.
Or just relying on open minds. We did the research for them. They
right.
could have just come to our website.
Right. So that could explain why the U.S. media didn't pick up
yeah.
on it, because they kind of burned themselves last time. But
yeah. Maybe they felt embarrassed. We made them look bad.
That's true.
Sorry, guys.
We're here to report the news for real.
For reals, yo.
Staying in China, there's been an increase in Hong Kong's UFO activity lately. On September 9th alone, there were 5 UFOs spotted. Wang Zichao, a planetary astronomer from the Purple Mountain Observatory, recently offered his explanation, stating that the UFOs were the result of ghost images from the reflection of the intense light emitted by outdoor circular lamps on the camera lens. It seems unlikely, though, that all of these UFOs, which were reported by several people, can be explained by ghost images from outdoor lamps.
Mm-hmm. I know that does happen a lot. I mean, and you see a lot of UFO photos where that happens. There's a famous one in Washington, D.C. going around that is supposed to be UFOs over the Capitol. And it's a cropped image. And if you see the uncropped one, there's these bright lights that you can tell are completely mirrored above the Capitol. But like you said, it would be awfully coincidental that this happened 5 times in the
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. People from, you know, they weren't all 5 people sitting in a living room saying, oh, look, from the same vantage
right.
point. They were different reports from different
yeah.
areas and different cameras taking different pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Unless all of Hong Kong has these circular lamps everywhere.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been.
Well, and then and all of them reporting that in one day, that doesn't really make sense.
Right. So it's kind of strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I pointed it out before. I'm just going to point it out again.
Okay.
That the several sources that reported this story, again, cited the Purple Hills Observatory, when in fact it's the Purple Mountain Observatory.
Yeah, lots of mistakes.
As far as I know, there is no Purple Hills Observatory.
Yep. Careless reporting.
Just thought I'd point that out.
Yep.
Get back to the U.S. here. A mysterious light display appeared in the southwest Florida sky last Tuesday night. Many coastal residents from Marco Island to Fort Myers Beach recorded the lights with their cell phone cameras and posted the videos to YouTube and Facebook. The lights were miles offshore and glimmered on and off for at least 20 minutes, according to witnesses. 911 received several calls about the lights. A spokeswoman for the Homestead Air Reserve Base said Air Force jets were performing routine training exercises in the Gulf that night, and the lights were merely flares dropped by aircraft. But multiple lifelong residents of the area say they have never seen anything in the sky like what they observed that night.
Mm-hmm. And now, were the pictures from the sighting, too?
They were. There were actually multiple videos of the sighting, too, showing the lights in the sky and showing them appearing and going out and sort of changing shape.
And they didn't look like flares, right?
Not real. I mean, flares can have that appearance, but the way they just, like, came on and went off and sort of, they didn't seem to be dropping or dropping consistently. You know, they seemed to move around.
Mm-hmm.
It's always possible there were flares, but these people didn't see any jets dropping the flares.
Yeah.
And these people living near this base see flares being dropped all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same story I had seeing the Phoenix lights back in 1997.
Yeah.
Growing up very close to where flares were dropped all the time by A-10s, what I saw with the Phoenix lights was not flares.
Right.
So I sympathize with these people.
Exactly. You've been there and done that.
That's right. Here's something from Arizona. A UFO was in the skies above Tucson last week. And similar to a sighting I reported last week about a UFO in China, where news reporters were able to record it with their cameras, the same happened in this situation. A photojournalist from the local ABC affiliate in Tucson saw the small blue object in the sky, so he set up his camera on a tripod and recorded it. They have no idea what the object was, but this isn't the first time that the channel has given airtime to UFOs. I don't know if you remember it, but when we were at the UFO Congress in February, Tucson also had a sighting that KGUN, the channel in Tucson, reported on. And we did that in the news segment on that show.
I remember that. I remember the sighting. This is an exciting one, too. I mean, hopefully, we probably should try to get a hold of these guys, because this guy was, he went out and got video. And you clearly see this little blue thing way up in the sky just sitting there.
Right.
It doesn't move. It's just there for a long period of time. He was obviously very shocked. They have great equipment there. It must have been extremely high because it's just a small dot in this video. But that's a great video. It's incredible. And what the heck could that be?
Right.
I mean, there's nothing that does that. It's not a planet or a star. It's midday. This is one of those, I think, very well-documented sightings that hopefully can be, and we should probably make a big deal out of. I think it's wonderful, too, that this guy did this.
I think it's really cool. The guy was interested enough to set up his tripod, set up his camera, and just mm-hmm. shoot the sky.
Yeah.
And the video is actually on the KGUN website. And there are actually some photos and blown-up photos showing the guy, showing the camera zoomed all the way in, showing mm-hmm. that just this tiny blue dot in the sky, and it's not moving. It's just hanging out.
One of the reasons it excites me, too, is because this is something that's commonly reported,
right,
where people will see something like that, and they'll say, hey, you know, and I've seen something like this, too. And I had a buddy who did and told me about it because he knew I was into this stuff, and he was all excited. He had a couple of incredible sightings. This one wasn't incredible, but he was at a party, and he saw something like this. And he's like, hey, check that out. What is that? What, you know, and everybody was looking up. Not everybody could see it because something like that gets hard to see, but a lot of people did, and, you know, nobody knew what the heck was going on, what that was.
Oh.
It's something sitting still up in the sky.
It happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But good for this guy for setting up his camera and getting it.
Yeah.
Really cool. Here's an update to a sighting story from back in August. A UFO was reported in St. Paul, Minnesota in early August and was later found by police to be a kite with LED lights attached to it. The 34-year-old man who was flying the kite was arrested by officers on an unrelated outstanding warrant. The kite flyer served his time and was released last Sunday, but he went right back to his night kite flying. Police were alerted to the lights in the sky, and they immediately knew what they were, LED lights attached to a kite. They found the kite flyer and cited him for disorderly conduct, public nuisance, and being in a playground after hours. And they even asked him, they said, hey, dude, what are you doing? Are you just trying to screw with people? He's all, yeah.
I know. Well, and I don't think they would have taken him to jail. That was one of the versions of the story I read. Because at first I was thinking that would be fun to put some lights on a kite, not to trick people, but just to, because there was another video similar to that out a few weeks ago where it looked like there's these LED lights around a balloon or something, and at night it looked really cool with these different shapes and stuff they were making, just that would be fun. And I was a little concerned, well, why would they send him to jail, you know, for that, or get him, why would he get in trouble for that? But they asked him, because they knew he had done this before, and like you said, they asked him, are you doing this to fool with people, make them think they're seeing a UFO? Yeah. Because that caused them, you know, lots of UFO calls, and the cops were busy answering calls, 911 calls about UFOs and stuff. So if he would have said, no, I'm just flying my LED kite, they probably would have left him, just told him, well.
Right. And it sounded like the officers were just frustrated with him and frustrated with dealing with the whole situation because they thought it was, you know, a waste of valuable resources.
Yeah. But otherwise, people, be a little careful. You know what? And this is one of the things that kind of frustrates me with people. If you think you're seeing a UFO, that's an extraordinary thing. It's worth getting on your bike or walking down the street or getting in your car and checking out. Because, you know, something similar like this has happened to me, and I rerouted and drove over by, and I found it was not what I thought it was. I can't remember the exact situation. Maybe it was a helicopter or something. But, you know, do at least a little bit of investigating, and you'll be able to see that it's a kite, because really people should be able to be – and I think we're going to have more of this. Kites with LEDs. Everything has LEDs.
Everything
now that
has
they're
LEDs.
Small, and it just takes a little computer to be able to do really cool things with all of these LEDs. We're going to see a lot more of these. I know there's airplanes, remote control airplanes, that you can get LEDs on and stuff like that too.
Right. They have these hovercraft and helicopters and things that have these whole LED kits that come with them.
Right. So you can fly them around at night for fun, and that would be cool. So, but then you get a lot of false UFO reports. So at least, you know, do a little bit of investigating. It's kind of fun. You'll feel like, you know, your Fox Mulder or your Scully out there on the hunt for a UFO.
It definitely pays to do a little investigation.
Yeah.
It's easy to do, especially if something is that close to you.
Yep.
You can sort of do some scouting around to eliminate possibilities anyway.
And a lot of people get scared, but you're probably going to find out, you know, it'll alleviate your fear that it wasn't what you thought it was anyway. Yeah. So.
In other news, Mark Pilkington, a British journalist and filmmaker, claims in his new book that the U.S. military has been responsible for seeding stories about UFOs to the public for the purpose of concealing secret military projects. In Mirage Men, An Adventure into Paranoia, Espionage, Psychological Warfare, and UFOs, Pilkington puts forth the claim that UFO stories have been used as a pretense for the flight testing of experimental and or secret aircraft. In an interview with U.S. News and World Report, Pilkington explains, just about everything that is popularly believed about UFOs has been exploited, shaped, and at times generated by people working for the U.S. Air Force and the intelligence community. He also acknowledges that through pop culture and paranoia, UFO stories tend to generate themselves thanks to the initial seeding by the military.
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting concept. I think that, you know, this is something James Carrion has gotten really into, that UFOs was kind of conjured up by the U.S. Air Force to trick the Russians, stuff like this. And maybe that is the case for some of this stuff. I mean, I think both could exist because things are so compartmentalized that there are probably CIA, Air Force disinformation agents or counterintelligence that don't even know UFOs are real, but they decide, hey, I'm going to use this to trick the Russians or trick so-and-so. And possibly it could be used for that purpose. At the same time, though, it doesn't answer everything because it doesn't answer all of these physical, the physical part of the phenomena going on and the history of it going on. And in fact, because these stories come up, I want to ask Leslie Keene about it and see what her thoughts are.
Well, unfortunately, in situations like that, that's where a lot of the paranoia and conspiracy start filling the void there and fabricating things that seem to make sense.
Yeah.
Coming up with their own theories. But.
Yeah, and that happens as well. It's a difficult field.
Yeah.
It's like actually something I read recently talking about how UFOs, you know, there's a lot of noise versus the sound. You know, the sound gets clearer, but there's a lot of noise, things that make static, like I'm hearing in my headphones. Jason, could you fix that? But like a lot of static, that kind of muddies the water. Assumption around some of these conspiracies and possible activities by the Air Force.
But I don't think they're going to tell us anytime soon.
Well, maybe if we ask nicely.
I haven't tried.
Yeah, I don't think that'll work either.
All right. And finally, multiple witnesses saw a gray-colored UFO hovering 5,000 feet above Nevada's Sand Mountain last week, according to an anonymous email sent to Las Vegas-based Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies. Bigelow Aerospace is a scientific research organization researching multiple parameters of advanced aerospace technology, emphasizing cutting-edge and futuristic aerospace projects. This is the same organization that currently has their expandable space habitation module in orbit around the Earth and has a goal of putting a hotel in space. Bigelow Aerospace is trying to locate witnesses to the Sand Mountain UFO sighting. The organization even has its own unidentified aerial phenomenon reporting hotline.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because, I mean, they've been taking sightings from the FAA. And Bigelow Aerospace, one thing that I think people kind of give them a hard time, but I think this is really cool that they're doing a little public outreach and letting people know about something, some of the stuff they're working on and asking about this sighting, because I think it's incredible. And it's one of the difficult things talking about the conspiracies that go on. All of a sudden, we have this aerospace company, this self-made millionaire who gets involved with UFO research, and people attack him. You know, you should do this, you should do that. Why are you doing things this way? Why are you doing things that way? When, you know, thank goodness we have this going on. We have someone helping us to discover stuff. And online right now, actually, you can find some of their papers that they've written analyzing some things like black triangles, Dulce. You know, in each case, in the triangle case, they found that the technology being exhibited is just too far advanced to be anything man-made. However, on the Dulce side, they did a thorough investigation of the Mesa there, and they didn't find anything, no vents, and they thought there's no way there could be a base under here. So, but at least they're thoroughly doing research, and I think we need to be appreciative of that. And I think it's really cool what Bigelow Aerospace is doing. I know Calm, they've done some great work, and the Utah Ranch stuff is amazing. I mean, people love that stuff. George Knapp is the one who helped write the book to get that out, but they've done some great work, and it's really cool to know that this aerospace company has kind of like this sci-fi or this X-Files department.
They've done a lot, they're doing a lot, and they have spent so much money researching this phenomenon. It's crazy.
And I'm not just kissing up because I want a ride to their space hotel.
So it doesn't hurt.
Yeah. Please give me a ride.
That's it for the news. Remember to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan, and you've been briefed.
Thank you, Jason. And before we end this segment and get Leslie Keene on, and I've got her book right here. Let me get my view of the camera to see if I'm – there we go. There, now it's in camera. There's her book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, Government Officials on the Record. I'm going to put it right here. And before we go to break and give her a call and get her on the line, I did also want to mention Dan Dillman and Ruben Uriarte. They were the guys who put on the UFO X-Fest that we were at this weekend. I want to thank them. They're awesome. They did a great job. The location, the Ball Theater, which is owned by Dan Dillman, is just an awesome place. If you're in the San Francisco area, check it out. Check out everything they've got going on there. He's going to do more of these UFO X-Fest too. And then Ruben Uriarte, who runs the Northern California MUFON, thank you. You're awesome. He's always doing a great job. And we'll talk a little bit more about him because he's the one who put on this wonderful San Jose MUFON symposium that mirrored Leslie Keene's press conference in Washington, D.C., that also spawned the wonderful book she's getting so much press for. So let's go ahead and take a break. Let's get her on the line, and we will talk more about this amazing book. Stay tuned. You're listening to Open Minds Radio. Hello and welcome. This is Alejandro Rojas, and you're listening to Open Minds Radio. And I am very happy to say that we have Leslie Keene on the line.
You know, most of the people in this book are older and retired, but not all of them. So he's one of the exceptions to that. His name is Captain Rodrigo Bravo Garrido, and he's from Chile.
Yeah, I remember his account. It's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's extraordinary that he's been able to get the permission also. I mean, again, one of the things this book highlights is the difference between the way the subject is treated in other countries as compared to our own country. And I think the Chilean situation is an example of that, where here this young captain was actually assigned the UAP subject, as he calls it, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. He was assigned to research these cases when he, as sort of his thesis, for joining, you know, for part of this training, and they turned over the files to him, and they wanted him to look at the cases and write a report about it. That's how he got started in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to imagine that he was assigned that and then has been completely free to talk about it, to visit America. I mean, he had to get permission for all these things, but the bottom line is he got permission to do it, to come and talk about it, and to, he's also continued investigating these cases, and he works closely with the official government agency there, headed by General Bermudez. So, you know, the country there is involved and responsible, and they're willing to allow their employees and their directors of their agencies to discuss this, and I think that's really commendable.
Right. Let's get into, we'll get more into some of the details on the book, but I want to go back also to how you kind of got here. Where was it that as a journalist, you know, working for a lot of the major media sources out there or writing for them, when was it that you took this issue seriously?
Well, it was actually in 1999, a number of years ago, and you're right, I was working for KPFA Radio, which is a Pacifica network in Berkeley, California, and I was co-producing and co-hosting, on-air hosting a daily investigative news program on that radio station. And I also had done a lot of freelance publishing as well, stories on various topics in a lot of newspapers around the country and overseas. So I did have a bit of a publishing track record at the time, as well as radio experience. And what changed it all for me was when I received the Cometa report in the mail from a colleague in France. And this was probably most of your listeners know, but for those that don't, this was a military study that was undertaken in France by a group of retired officials, including four generals, among them a four-star general, an admiral, and the former head of the National Space Agency in France, a former chief of police, and a number of other scientists and engineers and a government. The official had been heading up the government agency for many years. It was a very impressive group of people. And these guys did a three-year study of official UFO data on some of the best cases, interviewed many pilots, wrote up a report about it. And I was fascinated by the case reports as a journalist, but I was especially impressed by the conclusion that they came up with in this report, which was that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most rational and most valid and most likely even explanation for the cases that these gentlemen studied, which are, again, among the best cases, among that 5% of cases that really have great data, but we cannot explain them. So anyway, as a journalist, just to end the story, you know, I was just covering all these normal stories, and when this thing hit my desk, I sort of felt like, you know, wow, this is like really a big deal that people at that level would make a statement like that they believed, you know, that these things were very likely extraterrestrial vehicles. And I just thought, my God, this is a huge story. And I got very interested in it and wrote my first story in the year 2000 for the Boston Globe. And it was about the Cometa report that I wrote the story and did a bunch of research, which also went into the story. And from then on, I've been really fascinated by it and working at it pretty exclusively. But that's sort of how I got started. It was not something I expected would ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was just because of receiving this advanced English translation before anybody else of this amazing study out of France, and that changed everything for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's when we had Antonio Junias on, who's, of course, my colleague here at the magazine, so we've written a lot about France and Cometa online and in the magazine. But one thing, you know, that we kind of agree on is a lot of people talk about a lot of countries coming forward about UFOs and releasing files, but really there's no country out there that is truly investing investigation, an official investigation, and open in this subject like France.
Yeah, I think France definitely gets the gold medal, as I've said before, for a government agency. I mean, there are other countries that have government agencies, but I think you're absolutely right. France is really the model for the world. Part of it, I think, is because their agency is situated within their National Space Study Center, which is the equivalent of our NASA. So basically what that means is it's a purely research-based organization. You know, they're doing the work because they want to research a mysterious phenomenon, and it's more scientifically based. Whereas in a lot of other countries, the agencies are either civil aviation or air force or military-based, so they have a kind of a different thrust to them. But I think the sort of pure research aspect of the French agency, again, the more scientific approach has really aided that situation. And they've been doing this since the mid-70s, and they're still going at it with, you know, at least a number of people working at it, and they have a very well-set-up network of people around the country that assist them with, you know, laboratory studies, and police are all plugged into it. And, I mean, I went over there and talked to the people couple of years ago who run it, and it was just very, very impressive how they've got this whole network, and they meet regularly, and you know, they have collected a lot of fantastic data on cases and handled them very very scientifically. So I agree with you. I think they really, you know, we can all learn a lot from observing the way they've approached this.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, you know, the 3A is an organization over there that recently came out with a report that reiterated what you had mentioned earlier, is that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is still a possible cause for these UFOs. And I know it's something that you usually don't focus on, but it is, like I tell people, it's a fair hypothesis.
Absolutely. It's a rational hypothesis. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly fits the data. I mean, when we look at the data that we have on UFOs, we all have to ask ourselves, well, okay, if they're not man-made and they're not any kind of natural phenomenon, and we certainly know in many cases they are not secret aircraft that are being tested or some kind of human technology that's being tested, you know, then what are they? And we all ask that question, and so do the officials, so do the generals that, that study this. And I mean, you know, given what we know about the universe and the way the physical world works, it seems like, you know, logically we're all going to, our best guess is going to be that these are extraterrestrial things from somewhere else. And it's an extremely logical and rational deduction to make. So, and that's what these high-level officials agree on. They just also agree that we don't know 100% for sure, that we haven't proved that to the satisfaction of the scientific community, and that certainly needs to happen, and that's one of the things that the people who have come out of my book are all asking for, that you know, that we our government participate in a much higher level scientific investigation than has ever happened before, and that we sort of decide to become more proactive and try to get the scientific data that we need to really determine what they are, one, you know, definitively.
Right.
And but that's the only thing that's sort of missing. But yeah, there's the extraterrestrial hypothesis certainly seems like an extremely rational one, and I would agree with that.
So
that's what my sources have said too.
Yeah, yeah. But moving, I guess, to kind of move along the timeline with Cometa, another thing, because, you know, I think, you know, a lot of this stuff is, and I think others do too, a lot of what you've done since you've gotten involved are really important and, you know, monumental things that you've been able to accomplish in this field. And one of those that came eventually is your being able to work with John Podesta, who is, for those of who don't know, I'm sure they do. I talk about it a lot. He's was Clinton's chief of staff, and he helped with the transition for Obama and Biden into the White House. But you were involved with a press conference in the Sci-Fi where I think he made an incredible statement where he talked about releasing the documents being the right thing to do and being the law.
Yeah, I love that statement. I know it's been quoted a lot, and mm-hmm. The truth, and also the people can handle the truth, he said.
Right.
And he said something very similar to that in the foreword to the book, and I just want people to know that he is the man that wrote the foreword to the book, which is called, by the way, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And, I've been very happy that he began, as you said, back in the early days of the Coalition for Freedom of Information when the Sci-Fi Channel had kind of gotten this whole thing going, this Freedom of Information Act initiative that I became involved with it started in 2002. And John Podesta, that famous quote that he made was at a press conference that the CFI organized in cooperation with the Sci-Fi Channel. And he's just been willing to be kind of a public supporter of this work that we've all been doing, this group that I'm involved with, which because he's very much an advocate for government openness and believes that people can handle the truth and people have the right to the truth about everything, about all mm-hmm. the topics. But he happens to be curious and interested in the UFO subject. So he has been, very courageous and I think to just be publicly open about his support for it.
Right. And when did that relationship begin? How did he get involved with that initiative?
Well, back in 2002, when I started working and Larry Lansman from the Sci-Fi Channel launched this initiative and invited me to kind of spearhead it as a journalist, we had a team of professionals that were involved with this, and one of them was the public relations firm that was run by John Podesta's brother, Anthony Podesta. And it was called Podesta Mattoon at the time. I think now it's called the Podesta Group. But because of the connection, we were actually working with one of the representatives from that public relations firm was on our team and was part of our working with us on the effort that we were involved in, which partly involved the public relations aspect because we were giving press conferences and trying to get the media interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that relationship we had with Anthony Podesta's firm, his brother John because he was his brother and we knew that he was interested in the UFO subject, he was just invited to participate and was willing to do it. So that's how the whole thing started, and he's just sort of maintained, once I got involved in the lawsuit against NASA, which took many years, he was curious to see how that would unfold, and, I was keeping him informed about what was happening. So he's just, been kind of a curious and supportive person throughout the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it all got started.
So then the next press conference that came along went from some 5 years later, which I'm sure took a lot of work, is the big one that you put together with a lot of the people who are in your book.
Right. There was actually two press conferences we did initially with John Podesta at the beginning. That's a minor point. There's one in 2002, one in 2003.
Oh, okay.
You're right. And then in 2007, I co-organized this one with James Fox that you referred to, which was a very different kind of thing. I mean, this
right.
was a panel of top, officials from around the world. The earlier ones were specific to our Hexburg UFO Freedom of Information Act initiative. So the one with James was a much more high-profile, all-encompassing kind of event in which we brought these people in to each of them to sort of present their particular, whether it be their history as an investigator, as an official investigator, someone like Nick Pope, for instance, or whether they were actual witnesses to the event, such as General Parviz Jafari, who was actually a witness. So we had a combination of high-level witnesses and high-level government investigators in this panel in 2007. And it got a lot of media coverage, and that was when we sort of launched this government effort that expanded into the book, this effort to try to change government policy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was at that event that I actually met for the first time a number of the people who did end up writing for this book, and it was really great to have the opportunity to meet them and spend a few days with these incredible people. And it was also, for a lot of them, the first time they got to meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very profitable venture because people from different corners of the globe were able to come together and talk. You know, these people that have all had these very similar experiences but have never met. So
right.
That was important too. But it was a very, I thought, a very successful event.
Were you surprised that you were able to get so many of these guys to come here and talk, especially because they're from all over the world with, you know, these diverse backgrounds, even a general from Iran.
Right. Yeah, that was General Jafar. You know, that was the hardest. He was the hardest one to get. Not because he didn't want to come. He wanted to come. But getting the visa for him
mm-hmm.
was really complicated. It was expensive, too, but complicated. It took months for him to just get the paperwork together. He had to leave Iran and go somewhere in another country to go see some embassy there, and then, you know, it was this whole complicated, lengthy process. And he was finally able to get the visa, but, yeah, so there was a lot of work involved in just the logistics of getting them here. But I think that, you know, they really, they were willing to come, and I think a lot of the reason was because we were very careful to present a platform for them in which, you know, nothing was going to be overstated, no claims of extraterrestrial contact or the kinds of things that these kinds of officials might be uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody claiming that they understood what the UFOs were or anything kind of exaggerated, you know, is all very carefully put together in the kind of way that they, as officials, felt represented their particular positions. And they were comfortable with sort of the framework in which they were being asked to participate. And I think that's why they were really willing to
yep.
do it.
Which I think is one of the brilliant things about what you guys put together and the way that you and James Fox go about this field. I'm sure they felt they were in great company. I mean, they were with colleagues from around the world that were also very credible.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity for them to meet each other,
mm-hmm.
absolutely, and to meet with me and James and to make the points that they wanted to make. I mean, these are men who have such close contact with this situation, this UFO phenomenon, whether it be both through witnessing it or investigating it, they care a lot about it, and their lives have been changed by their involvement, and they are all people that, you know, if they can speak about it in the context that works for them, they are motivated to do it because of the impact this has had on them. So these were all people that were, I think, grateful and willing to speak about it when given the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was impressive, or one of the people, well, they were all very impressive, but when we did the MUFON symposium with your help and got a lot of these guys to the symposium, I particularly really was surprised by General DeBrower because I was excited to see his talk, and he had put together, he had an entire PowerPoint that later I asked him, and he had put it together himself. It was very impressive. And, I mean, he had a whole talk just – he was so open with no hesitation, so open to talk about all of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I thought his presentation was just really great. Mm-hmm. I have to agree with you. And, you know, at the press conference, he could only talk for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But when he went to the MUFON conference, which was the next summer, so this was even less than a year, I was – summer of 2008, I remember very well, he was able to give a full-length presentation, and that was really what he most wanted to do. I remember when we brought him into Washington, he had a very hard time accepting the fact, because I was communicating with him on email to get him here and everything. He had a hard time accepting the fact that he could only talk for like 4 or 5 minutes.
Mm.
He really wanted more time. And he did. He put together a fabulous presentation with lots of, as you said, written PowerPoints, but also great drawings and
right.
photographs and all kinds of interesting stuff. And he's extremely accurate. He's a very meticulous very carefully meticulous person, you know, who's very careful about being accurate with every single, I mean, you wouldn't believe the editing that he did on his chapter for the book. Yeah, he wrote a fantastic chapter for the book, and he's so careful and so just absolutely meticulous about it. So that's the kind of talk he gave, and yes, he's very open.
Mm-hmm.
He's very willing to share everything that happened to him when he was working on this Belgium wave in 1989 and 1990 and all the things that went on and what his thoughts are about it. And he's a man who cares a great deal about solving this mystery and cares a great deal about it being taken seriously. And he's really stands behind that.
Yeah,
and he did a great presentation. He's also written a very compelling chapter for the book, too.
Yeah, he's a very approachable, nice person, too. Just he was a really great guy.
I remember how wonderful it was to have him there. Yep.
Well, we're going to take just a short little break, just a couple minutes, so we can just kind of do what we have to do for a minute.
Okay.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to Open Minds Radio, and we will be right back with Leslie Keene, the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, a New York Times bestseller. Stay tuned.
Open Minds Magazine, the exciting new publication by Open Minds Production, is in stores now. Open Minds Magazine is your look inside the fascinating world of UFO-related phenomena, including extraterrestrials, abductions, cattle mutilations, crop circles, alien implants, and more. Open Minds Magazine provides readers with current research, investigations, and news, all delivered in a stunning graphical presentation. Pick up your copy today and prepare to have your mind open. That's Open Minds Magazine, available now at Barnes & Noble, Borders, and online at openminds.tv.
Having been referred to as the CNN of UFOs, OpenMinds.tv is the hub for news relating to the alien UFO phenomenon. With daily updates of exclusive photos, videos, merchandise, and investigations, OpenMinds.tv is bringing UFO and extraterrestrial research to a global audience. The website features the OpenMinds store stocked with books, DVDs, and other merchandise, including OpenMinds magazine. Visit OpenMinds.tv, the definitive source for UFO-related news. That's www.openminds.tv.
Open Minds Production is proud to present the 20th anniversary of the International UFO Congress, coming to its new home at the Radisson Fort McDowell Resort and Casino in Scottsdale, Arizona. This is the premier annual event for UFO researchers, enthusiasts, and the general public with an interest in mysterious phenomena. Come listen to expert ufologists, government officials, and respective scientists presenting information relating to UFOs, extraterrestrials, crop circles, abduction, cover-ups, and more at the largest UFO conference in the country. The 20th anniversary of the International UFO Congress takes place February 23rd through February 27th. Visit UFOCongress.com for more information, including sponsorship and vendor opportunities.
Welcome back to Open Minds Radio. Here now, former official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network, your host of Open Minds Radio, Alejandro Rojas.
Welcome back. This is Alejandro, and I am here with Leslie Keene. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I think your book kind of, by its very nature, kind of disproves this concept, but there was a recent book written that the entire UFO phenomena is really a disinformation project by the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that idea?
You mean meaning that every sighting is a result? I don't quite follow.
But in that the whole idea has been reinforced by the Air Force, and that, yeah, essentially the public has taken on this mythology, and now since it's in their mind that this whole UFO thing was really just all a disinformation kind of.
But then, how would you explain the sighting? Because that was the case. How would you explain the physical data and the I haven't read the book, and I don't really know what it is you're referring to, but I don't think that. Some of the best cases that we have, and certainly the ones that are brought forward in my book by the actual sources themselves and are backed up by multiple witnesses and radar and photographs and government documents and all the things that we have, so we know exactly what happened. We have lots of detail about it, and you have a physical thing there doing certain things. I don't really see how that can be explained as Air Force disinformation when you have something physical that actually happened.
Well, and like you demonstrate, it's international as well.
Well, it's absolutely international, everywhere around the world. So I don't know if this new book is stating that every case was therefore some kind of technology, or I mean, what is the theory about how you would explain all these different cases?
Well, I think essentially he's saying that there are misrepresentations and that people, because this idea of UFOs and is so popular, that people are prone to call something a UFO without carefully determining what it is.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably true, and certainly, mm-hmm. I mean, I do make the point in the book, and so have a lot of other people, that 95% of all sightings can be explained, and I'm sure a lot of the ones that, you know, are just what you're saying, that people sort of project the idea of a UFO onto something strange that they see, but that's 95%. There are 5% that absolutely cannot be explained that way, and these are the ones that we're concerned about. I mean, and so I think this gentleman may be making a valid point for the cases that we're not concerned about, the ones
right.
that in fact are explainable or that are something other than a truly unexplainable physical phenomenon, which the problem is we're stuck with those cases.
Right.
You know, the ones that have been extremely well researched and have so much documentation that you absolutely cannot explain them any other, you know, that they are a physical phenomenon well documented and unexplained. So it's not to say that his point isn't valid, but I don't think it applies to the absolute best cases we have that have been officially investigated and documented, such as the ones in the book, such as the Belgian Wave or the Hudson Valley Wave or many other, you know, the Bentwaters case, the Rendlesham Forest incident,
mm-hmm.
any other cases.
Right, and that's what gets a little frustrating with the field, and maybe we'll see how, because you've dealt with some skeptics, like James Oberg of MSNBC, the space correspondent, you know, what he wrote about you and your book, in that often these sort of explanations, which don't really explain what your book is even referring to, somehow get adopted by, you know, SETI scientists or like James Oberg and repeated when they're not really looking at the details.
I think you're right. And what's really interesting to me about what you just said and what James Oberg said, they're actually making points sometimes that really aren't even applicable.
Right.
To what it is that they're criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just sort of throw it out there, and it's sort of a sloppy thing, and, that, you know, maybe some of the people that are skeptical anyway and don't want to accept this can sort of latch on to it and say, oh, yeah, well, he's discredited it. But there's no real intellectual honesty behind it. That's the thing.
Right.
I mean, for Albert to say, pilots are not a good observers, because for the cases that where there's a need to have a very fast response, a 2 or 3 second response because of some kind of dangerous threat that a pilot is perceiving, he makes the point that in those situations, pilots can misidentify things. Well, yeah, nobody would disagree with that, but the problem is it has nothing to do with the content of my book.
Right.
Which has no cases in it, or the major cases in the book, let's say, that are explored, are not situations where pilots are have 2 seconds to respond to danger. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's presenting points that really don't even apply to the data. And I think it's just the kind of thing that happens, as you've said many times over and over again.
Yeah.
Skeptics that you know, want to just, at all costs, want to make this subject implausible and want to be able to explain it away. And they will go to great lengths to do that, no matter how implausible, irrational, or dishonest the attempts are to do it. And we just see this happening over and over again. I'm so curious about the motivations of these debunker types. I mean, I really don't know what drives them to behave the way they do. And I'd love to be inside their heads sometime and learn a little more about what motivates them.
Especially someone who, like James Oberg, he writes for MSNBC. I mean, he's a very major journalist out there and one of the most popular websites and news sources out there, and he's writing for it. And unfortunately, often when it comes to this subject, they're allowed to not really demonstrate the journalistic integrity that they normally would for any other story.
Well, that's true. I think with UFO subject, yeah, that's a good point. You know, because it's such a difficult subject for people to accept, all kinds of things go on and all kinds of standards are applied that I guess are not often applied, especially in terms of people's lack of willingness to even accept the subject. So you're right. I mean, not all subjects are treated that way.
I was happy, though, that MSNBC did publish, though, your retort, which your rebuttal, which often they don't do.
Well, I was really, I have to say, I'm very thankful to James Oberg for writing the piece that he wrote, because it allowed me the opportunity to write a piece for MSNBC.com, which talked a lot about the book and allowed me to present more material about the book. And so it was actually a great opportunity for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was pleased to address the points that he made. And I think that I, you know, really pointed out the holes and the problems with what he was saying. And so the whole thing was to my benefit, really. And I'm thankful to him for giving me that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that was brought back into the public's eye and, again, became a very popular story because of, well, some of the interviews that you had done, was the O'Hare incident in 2006, where there was a sighting over the airport. The story was the largest, most popular story on the Chicago Tribune. And I noticed that, I think it was after you were on the Colbert Report, that it once again became one of their more popular stories.
Yeah, I thought that was really amazing, too. I mean, it just shows the power of national television, where, you're right, it came from the Colbert Show, and, you know, he made a comment about, we somehow got into a few lines, really. It wasn't that long, but we were talking about the O'Hare case. And just as a result of that, all these people were going on Google and searching it, and they ended up at the Chicago Tribune website, and it started to get all these hits again on that case, and the Tribune actually ended up writing a little piece about it. So it's kind of amazing. That was really amazing to me, and I thought, well, this national television business is pretty powerful when you can generate, you know, a comment on it, that he, in a brief discussion like that, leads to this kind of attention being placed on this case. So that was really great.
Yeah, that was cool to see, and it was also great to see Hilkovich, the writer of the story for the Tribune, to also do interviews again on the case and still stick to his guns, where he really ran into the same issues that we run into as civilian investigators, where official organizations are kind of giving us the runaround and then changing their stories from what their original story was to their final conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he ran into when he was looking into the O'Hare case at the beginning. You're right, where the FAA originally wouldn't say anything, and then they gave us the explanation that what the pilots were seeing were airport lights reflecting off the clouds. That was the first attempt, and he learned from them. Soon after that comment was made, it was determined that the airport lights were not even on at the time of the incident because it was too early in the day, you know, but it didn't stop the FAA from throwing that one out. And so then they moved on to the famous weather explanation. But, yeah, I mean, I think Hilkovich was kind of amazed by many things about this case that he wasn't used to dealing with because his, you know, as a transportation writer, he just writes more or less fairly straightforward, mundane stories. And when he came into this one with also the way the aviation safety aspect was handled, I mean, he was really surprised at the lack of interest that the FAA had in a case involving safety issues. And made the comment that, you know, normally the slightest little safety violation, he used the example to me of a coffee pot coming loose in the galley, say.
Mm-hmm.
Kitchen of the airplane, a coffee pot comes loose during the landing of the plane. Even something like that is checked out and investigated by the FAA.
Wow.
But here you have a strange object hovering over the United Airlines terminal, and they're completely uninterested in it. And that really kind of floored him because he was coming in looking at this from the outside. He'd never had any experience with the UFO issue in before, like so many of us have, so we weren't so surprised for those of us who were familiar with the government's normal response to these sightings, but he was really kind of floored by that because so many of the witnesses were concerned about these safety issues.
Right.
As, and he was sort of said, you know, he didn't get why they were so blasé about it or why they were so disinterested.
Why do you think that's the case?
Oh, boy, well, that is certainly a complicated question. I mean, and I think it goes back to the 50s, really. The origin of it was back in the 50s with the, you know, when there were so many sightings and the Air Force was just beginning to kind of grapple with the overwhelming numbers of sightings that were coming in. And then you had the CIA Robertson panel convened where they handpicked a bunch of scientists to come together to figure out a way to sort of handle the over the volume of reports that were clogging up their systems, and they were concerned about the Russians taking advantage of this. And that's when they came out with this recommendation that the UFO subject should be debunked. I mean, they used the word, that it should be debunked in the media and in documentary films and television and advertising and all these things. And I think it just became sort of the standardized approach. The Project Blue Book for years was making up, you know, ridiculous explanations for cases that didn't really apply, but they would just wanted to explain them away. And then J. Allen Hynek in the 70s coming out with his own admission that this is, you know, how irresponsible and the Blue Book people were and how they didn't, you know, they, I mean, he verified all of this after Blue Book closed in 1970, but the trend was just so in, deeply ingrained in the official approach to the UFO issue and the cultural approach as well. And I just think, you know, there hasn't been enough to really happened to break through that. It's become sort of a pattern and, you know, and to what extent there is some kind of secret investigation going on, we don't really know, but I'm sure that there are agencies that have are still investigating this. So it's a bit of a mystery as to why it goes on. I mean, it has to look through at the history, I think.
And
but, you know, and it's just sort of the way we've been doing this since the 50s.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm hoping that the book is going to be able to use as a tool to try to do something about that and really get the political establishment to reevaluate it and to just take some small steps towards changing that.
Would you say you have a strategy in helping make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a loose strategy. I mean, it's a strategy that's amendable to many different possibilities, but we have proposed in the book the idea of working towards establishing a simple and small government office, an official focal point for UFO investigations. And again, sort of modeled after the one in France, maybe even smaller scale in terms of the actual staff. But anyway, you know, this is the model that we're putting forward in the book, and that this could be set up without a lot of fanfare, without a lot of expense, just kind of quietly become part of the huge establishment at the Defense Department or within some government agency, to have a small office where some person there is responsible for coordinating investigations into UFO events that happen and networking with other countries, networking with professionals around the country, so that if we have another incident like we did at O'Hare, there is somebody in an official capacity that's prepared to properly investigate it. That's what we would like to see change, in similar with the way they do it in France.
Right.
Where, you know, they will go out and they have access to all the data, which is what's so important. You know, a civilian group like MUFON or NARCAP or any of us, individual journalists like myself, with, you know, to get information is really a challenge, as it was for Hilkovich, and you got to go through the Freedom of Information Act. It takes a lot of time. But when you have an actual government official in place who he can walk into the to O'Hare Airport and the information is all provided to that person. He doesn't have to wait around. You know, he can get his hands on all the information and can conduct all the interviews necessary. And in an ideal scenario, none of those witnesses at O'Hare should have any reason to be afraid to put their names on the record, which they all were. But
right.
They wouldn't be if we had this official agency set up. So that's what our, anyway, our strategy is to try to bring about something along those lines.
What's to keep an organization like that from becoming like a blue book, or what the blue book was alleged to be, kind of a public-facing research organization that didn't have access to everything they should have had access to, including all of the reports.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true that whether the staffer would have access, he's not going to have access to the top secret, classified reports. I'm sure of that. But I think the focus is more on making it possible for a proper investigation to be done in the future than it is to try to get a lot of more documents released, although that could be part of the job too. But I think what really, first of all, this is so long since Project Blue Book. I mean, I don't think that there's any reason to assume that we would have the same problems. I think a lot of what we have to do is have a civilian advisory board, and this is what they do in DAPON too, that oversees and works closely with the staff people there and has quarterly meetings and provides expertise and advice and information to the people in charge of this agency, because they're not going to know a whole lot about UFOs. If you have a staffer from the Air Force, let's say, assigned to take this on, as was Nick Pope, for instance, at the Ministry of Defense in the UK, he didn't know anything about the subject when he started.
Right.
So we propose having a board of advisors composed of former military people, top-notch scientists, expert researchers, a very expert group of people that can sort of guide and oversee the organization to make sure that everything is made public and to just make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of Project Blue Book. I mean, I think that if something like this were established today, it would really be done with the proper intention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very different climate now than it was back in the 50s when Blue Book was set up, and there were so many reports, and the Air Force was overwhelmed and completely baffled by what was going on. And, I think we've come a long way since then. We have other agencies around the world that this office could interact with, and I just, I think there would be enough positive influence on this particular office that we could avoid those problems.
Yeah, well, I like the idea of the civilian oversight too, or involvement. We have organizations like the SSE of scientists who are educated in, many of them educated in this field. And also we have larger organizations like yours and MUFON and to be watchdogs over this group. Because I think about that a lot, what could we do now to influence that kind of thing? And I think another great thing about what you're doing here is providing information. A lot of people, pound the doors of the White House and tell the politicians, you got to tell us the secrets. But as we know, the politicians don't all have those secrets.
No, I would say none of them do.
So they need information.
You're absolutely right. There's sort of this naive assumption, I think, on a lot of people's parts that, oh, there's this cover-up, and, if we can just get to the right member of Congress, they know this, and the other one knows this. And, these people the elected officials are not privy to deep, dark secrets about the UFO issue, and they're not even concerned about it. I mean, they have their focus is on many, many other things. So I think that's one of the reasons why we don't want to emphasize in our approach to government officials any kind of accusations of covers-ups or things that happened many decades ago. I mean, these current officials have nothing to do with that, and they're not informed about the deep, dark stuff. So we just need to actually approach them with a positivity and an invitation that they feel inspired to respond to, which is more along the lines of, hey, America, you're so important. We need your help. And, to appeal to them in a positive light, rather than to be accusing them of having done all these horrible things 60 years ago.
I mean, right.
It's a matter of strategy and a matter of deciding which method is more likely to yield the results that we want.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that because, I mean, right now, obviously, we're not getting very far, and I think if we can educate our leaders on these various credible incidents like your book does, then they have more in their arsenal to become interested in the first place, and then to also seek answers or to seek to establish a research group desk like you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's true, and I think the book really gives them the absolutely key, irrefutable, documented information that they need about the UFO subject to be serious about it. I think it's all there in this book, and it's enough to make it compelling for them to take this on, and I'm just hoping that the book, and that's one reason why I'm so hopeful that lots of people will read it and that it will do well, is because, you know, the more recognition it gets, the more useful it's going to be as a tool, you know, getting it into the right hands, getting these people to become aware of this information. And this is information presented in a way that they can relate to, you know, with the right kind of language, the right people, the right kind of documentation. It's one thing I've learned over the years is I've learned sort of how to communicate with these people in official positions. What's their language and what can they accept? And I think this book really encapsulates the best possible information for them. And I just hope very much that people will read it and talk about it and get it out there into the hands of people who are in a position to affect policy and to affect attitudes in the culture.
Right. Well,
I think it could really has the potential to be a tool for that purpose. And
that's
my ultimate goal in really in writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that that happens.
Well, I think, it shows that people are reading it because it was on the New York Times bestseller list. And I think most books that hit the New York Times bestseller books list, especially one that kind of stands out in a particular genre like this one, helps define kind of the paradigm that people and the evolution of how people think of UFOs. And that alone, I think, is extremely significant. So I think you've already succeeded in making a huge difference once again.
Well, thanks a lot. I hope you're right, and I think you're right. I mean, I've been very, very pleased with what's happened so far, and we've been on the bestseller list for 3 weeks. And
was that a surprise?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it is. It's a huge surprise, but at the same time, it's not. It's a very strange perception for me.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you can understand that. I mean, because, you know, when I was writing this book, I was thinking, you know, my God, this is just incredible stuff. And my God, you know, how could people not read this? And how could they read this and not be, like, totally knocked over by it?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you follow that thought, and that, you know, then you think, well, yeah, of course it's going to be a huge deal when it comes out, and, yeah, why wouldn't it be on the bestseller list, and why wouldn't everybody be amazed at this phenomenal story, you know? And so on that level, I'm really not surprised. But on the other hand, I'm also really surprised.
I think it proves.
For obvious reasons. So,
yeah. I think it proves what the numbers show, that there, I mean, if 30%, which is some of the most conservative numbers out there, of the number of people who believe in UFOs or believe there's something to the subject, that's a lot of people. And I think your book proves that those people really are out there, and they're just in the closet.
Yeah, I agree, and I think those are the people that hopefully buy the book initially. But as I've said, I really wrote it intended for the people who don't know anything about UFOs, who don't necessarily already even have any opinion about them at all, and who wouldn't even normally buy a book about UFOs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the person. That's why, you know, some of this case information might be familiar to a lot of people in MUFON who have studied UFOs for a long time. This book was geared towards a person who knows absolutely nothing about them.
Mm-hmm.
And an intelligent person who's skeptical, who wouldn't normally be concerned or think about UFOs, who wouldn't normally buy anything on it. So I hope that, you know, those are the people, and I know that there are a lot of those people reading the book, because I've heard from so many people, and lots of people on my Facebook page and my blog, people have written who are just regular people who were never concerned about this before and have picked up this book. So that's so gratifying to me, that it's really reaching a whole new audience, which is what I hope continues to happen.
I am just, you know, so excited about this book. UFOsOnTheRecord.com is the website. There's even more I know I would have loved to talk about. Maybe hopefully we can get soon, but we're out of time now. I am just, you know, thank you for what you've done. Here again, I think what you've done in the past has been extremely significant, and here you've done it again. I just really get tickled when people like you come forward with these incredible pieces of work, and I'm very excited about it. So,
well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And, yeah, I would love everyone to go to my website, which is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. And Amazon has a very cheap price on the book right now. So
great. It's on sale on Amazon.
That's a good place to get it. Yep.
All right.
Alejandro, I appreciate the being with you tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having you on the show. And we'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Okay. Take care. Thanks.
Next week on Open Minds Radio, we're going to have Robert Vandenbroek. This is a very controversial case out of Holland, and we're going to have Nancy Talbot on, who's investigating this case. Crop circles and strange pictures and strange substances found in these crop circles, all rigorously and scientifically explored by Nancy Talbot. That's next week. It's an exclusive for OpenMinds.tv, so be sure to join us for that. It's going to be a ton of fun. Really, I think we're going to be the only ones who's ever had this guy on the air. Talk to you then. Open Minds Radio, your UFO news authority. Talk to you next week.